Last week, the last slides have been about multilateral security. And already last week, I gave you slightly different definitions because I gave you some kind of history. So this was the oldest definition, the original definitions, and then slight modifications that we start not only with protection goals, but with particular goals of each party. And the last variant was that we say there may be limitations in how security properties can be enforced, and if so, they equally apply to all parties. So this was the last slide we had last week. And first, do you have any questions? As each week, this is the first question to ask. Anything which stayed unclear, where you want to go back, which I should tell you again, anything?
So the first is pretty clear for the person who works in a company. And the second one, I doubt about the fact how could they negotiate between each other. For instance, two different companies which somehow agree on common rules. How is it commonly done in practice?
Okay. In practice, of course, there are quite different scenarios. You just said we have two companies. Then probably each company has within the small print of the contracts they do some regulations, what kind of accountabilities they take, what kind of guarantees they give. And usually if you read the fine print within these contracts, then usually the fine print is very much in favor of the party writing down the contract. So if two companies want to do some business with each other, probably their fine print is contradictory. And now, of course, the question arises, hey, what kind of fine print now is valid? It starts with very simple things. Let's assume a US and a European company do some business, then the US company will have in their fine print the law of the US applies, and the European company will have in their fine print European law applies. So which law applies? How they have to find out. So particularly with companies, I think it's pretty clear that if they do contracts with each other for the first time, they have to make sure that it's clear what the rules are, because there may be and there surely will be differences. With natural persons, if you do business with each other, at least if both persons are living in the same country, then probably by default, you have a consistent set of rules. The law applies. If the two persons are in different countries, then of course you have to decide, or they have to decide, or it has to be decided, the law of which country applies. If it's a company and a private person, then probably the situation is severely asymmetric, because the company usually has a lot of fine print, and the natural person, the usually consumer, is in a position, take it or leave it. Usually, if you write an email to Amazon, hey, I would be willing to buy some books, but first we have to change this part of your fine print, then probably in the end you won't buy books with Amazon.com. So what I don't say is that each party will be willing to negotiate. If Amazon, for example, feels strong enough, they just will say, hey, we impose these regulations. And then take it or leave it. So, but even if they do so, if you have worked out your protection goals, if you know what you want, even if you don't get it, I would say you learned something because you know what your risks are. And maybe even if, for example, Amazon.com doesn't change, maybe this is an idea for another company. Userfriendly.com, having another kind of fine print or having a capability to negotiate with people, a willingness to negotiate. And then, of course, in the long run, maybe the market decides. So the outcome of multilateral security is not that in the end each party is equally strong. This would be quite unrealistic. But what we hopefully can make sure is that each party knows what kind of security it gets, what kind of accountability it takes, what risks remain. So making that explicit. And at least as long as all parties are willing to do some negotiation, maybe arriving at a good compromise. Of course, if some party is not willing to agree to a compromise, then they may just insist on its protection goals. And if the other then do the transaction nevertheless, then of course that party just insisting on something, in some sense, did win. But I'm not sure if winning that way in the long run will be very beneficial for being successful on the market. Okay, so this was a pro. The contra is, hey, if you want to do business, you want to buy a book, you want to get a book, you are bothering about books, you are not bothering about security, you are not bothering about the small print of Amazon.com. And therefore, somehow, this is slightly naive, because most people don't care for security. If you ask them whether they care, nearly everybody will say yes. But if you look at how they behave, many tend to ignore it. And therefore, probably to make that kind of scheme practical, we need some kind of computer support. So maybe Amazon.com has to write down their small print in a computer readable and understandable form. So on your browser, just before clicking I agree to all terms and conditions, maybe you need some kind of pop-up window telling you, hey, the essential restrictions for your consumer rights to whom you are just going to agree are this and that. And then maybe a second option, hey, the company is willing to do some kind of negotiation. So let's say if you accept a few cents increase in the price, then you get better warranty, better rights. Some of the risks are taken by the company. And then you decide. What I want to say is, if we are designing security not according to those lines, then it's not possible just to negotiate about security properties. If it's hard-coded, then it's really difficult to change. So I would argue if we do security, we should do it that way. This is the right framework. I'm not saying, hey, the world is fair in the sense that all parties are equally strong. This would be really naive. So maybe you got the spirit what I mean? Okay. Any further questions? Okay. Then we get to your homework. I gave you three slightly different definitions, and now I'm asking you, what other definitions did you find? What other definition did you think about? How would you try to express what is important to you? So, what did you think? What did you come across?
Well, I read some paper about multilateral security from some guy from Cambridge, I guess. And there he made a comparison of multilateral security that, for instance, there is some secret service, and secret service has its agents in many countries. And the agency bureaus in each country should somehow possess these multilateral security mechanisms, because in such a way that they are isolated from each other. But they're common. But the common, they say that the multilateral security has some common backbone for the participating parties. And I think in business it might be that the common backbone might be the communication pipeline between the two or several companies who work together. So if we want to apply multilateral security, we must have something in common. Otherwise, we don't need to do the steps of negotiation, for instance. We just can try to keep all the attackers physically, logically, and so on outside our system and not bothering about negotiating. So I would add to this, maybe to this definition, I find it very it's a basic thing you should understand. And also maybe some punk somewhere, some strich, that there should be somehow somewhere common backbone or common interests. Otherwise, we don't need to negotiate and to agree on something. If I don't want to buy a book from Amazon, I don't use this. I just go to the shop where I don't need to click this button, I agree. And maybe apply with them my something security.
So maybe I should make something explicit, which until now only was implicit. Of course, if I say parties start into some kind of negotiation, then probably those parties have to have some kind of interests with at least to some degree match each other's interests. So if you are interested in buying books, Amazon is interested in selling books, so maybe this is then some kind of match. Of course, there are, at the next level of refinement, there may be differences. The consumer will be interested in buying books at a very cheap price. Amazon, in principle, would be interested in getting a price as high as possible. So everything starts that somehow interests match. If there's no match of interest in any sense, then probably it's just no good idea trying to do some transaction with each other. So if you have some kind of matching, then usually, if you look closer, it's not a complete match. The price, for example, is an example in the book buying case where interests are different. So if you look closer, you say, hey, in principle, we would like to cooperate doing some transaction, but there are some details we have to talk about. One is price. Another detail is who takes what kind of risk. If I'm shipping the ware, if it never arrives, what happens? Is this the risk of the shipping party, or is this the risk of the recipient? Can be negotiated. Or if we are talking about payment, who takes the risk whether the payment arrives? Is it enough for the consumer to say, hey, this money is deducted from my account? Or do you have to prove that it arrived with Amazon? So it starts that there is some kind of common interest, but usually, if you look closer, then there are some kind of conflicts or not really matching interests. And usually this is a point where security issues start. As I mentioned, security is not mainly about the good guys against the bad guys, but security gets an issue if people concerned with something have different interests. Then we have to make sure what interests get priority. To what degree which interests get priority. What are the compromises? What are the deals with respect to the conflicting interests? And this is a kind of write-up saying, hey, this is a normal case, and security should adapt to the normal case, how people live their lives. Okay, so how would you radically differently describe multilateral security? Probably there are quite other definitions. Maybe you just pass the mic.
I would not say it's really different, but first of all, I would start with the negotiation point. I think the logical consequence of if the parties are negotiated is some kind of contract where the rules are written down and so on. And on the last point, each party can enforce. Yeah, it's a problem. I don't think Amazon has its own policemen to enforce the contract rules. So I think we need an independent entity or, I don't know, control instance, which has the rights and rules and the force to ensure that the goals in this contract are fulfilled by both parties. So I think we need this instance which is accepted by both parties and which has this power to enforce one of the parties if they break the rules.
In the examples I used, I asked which laws do apply, and probably in asking which laws do apply, this usually has a quite matching or correlation. Hey, which policeman, which country is in charge of enforcing those rules? And in the meantime, we hope that the government has a monopoly with respect to physical force. I think culturally, this is a huge step forward. Before that, the right was always on the side of the more strong person and not the person behaving more fairly or having better arguments or whatever. So what I surely, if I'm talking about enforcement in the computer science sense, I assume that we are living in a somehow civilized world, that the police, the government, has some kind of monopoly for exercising physical force. There are very few exceptions. If you see someone killing someone else, of course, you are allowed, you're entitled, maybe to some degree even obliged to intervene. But normally, it's the police exercising physical force. So this is not what I understand as a computer scientist as enforcement. If I'm talking about enforcement, it may be that, hey, my computer is secured that you cannot just hack into it. Or enforcement may mean in doing transaction with you, I get messages from you which are properly authenticated. I check the authentication and I can take the message I got from you as proof, maybe in a court trial, that you really did send the message and I acted accordingly. And so it's your fault if now you decide that you never ever wanted to have that book. Let's assume we are talking about publishing on demand, so the book is just done when you ordered it. Usually, if it's about ordinary books, then probably no one will really make much fuss about it, and usually Amazon takes back some books. Okay, so enforcement is meant in the computer science jargon, not about military, police, violence. This is not what I'm talking about. Okay. Any other definition or any other way to challenge that definition? Okay, then I did write that down with some colleagues, and I did this exercise for several years. And a few years ago, someone stood up and said, hey, what you are talking about is mainly this. It's about Immanuel Kant. It's about his point of view about fairness, and more particularly, it's about something called categorical imperative, which reads, you should act that how you act, the principle of you acting, could be the principle of general law. Put simpler, you should act as you would like to be treated or acted upon. So probably behind the kind of definition of multilateral security, where I have to accept that others have security interests as well, as I would like them to accept that I have security interests as well. So this, in some sense, is Immanuel Kant applied to computer security. So probably, many of you, hopefully all of you, had a feeling, hey, this kind of definition for multilateral security sounds fair, sounds good. At least sounds better as the good guys against the bad guys. Or sounds better than, hey, the all-powerful company just defines what security shall mean because they know better. And the consumers just have to take it. And if you start thinking about it, and it was a student bringing that up, of course I had it without explicitly thinking about it in the back of my head, because as a Jurisprudence citizen, I have that kind of ethics in the back of my head when arguing. So mainly I would argue multilateral security can be understood, can be framed as the categorical imperative brought to security. This would be another definition. And then, of course, now this is very, very broad. Now I have to break it down. What does it mean? And maybe then you arrive at some kind of definition, as I did. Did you have other ideas? Ever other kinds of definitions? Hey, you should do some exercises with respect to fantasy. What are other possibilities to suggest that multilateral security could be a good idea? Hey, you're computer scientists. What is one of the main advantages of computers? You buy the hardware, And what they shall do, you decide later. Because changing the software is relatively easy compared to reconstructing the hardware, right? So probably this is one of the advantages and one of the success factors of computers. Now back to security. Maybe I should go back to the PowerPoint. If you define security that way, what's the advantage? How can you motivate that kind of definition? That is, we have some kind of framework, we go at some kind of meta level, and what security then in particular means within a transaction is decided when the transaction is going to take place. So if this is the kind of hardware, so we nail down these principles in hardware, we take that fixed, and then if your concrete security interests change over the next years, you get maybe different protection codes. You employ different behavior with respect to negotiation. But the scheme still is valid. So if you go for the contrary and say, hey, in just formulating some kind of transactions, we then just in detail formulate what the corresponding security properties shall be, then it gets pretty inflexible. Maybe the security in 5 years is not strong enough. Maybe in the early phases, security is too strong because it's too expensive to do, to employ the security mechanisms. So in this scheme, we say some kind of fairness principle, some kind of flexibility, but then we leave it to the actors at the latest point where the decision really has to be made, immediately before the transaction. So giving more flexibility and dynamics, and I would say more empowerment to the real users. So this would be another way to motivate it. So a slogan could be multilateral security is a way of getting security as flexible as can be. And the contrary would be, hey, those guys imposing security, they impose how we behave, which is probably not really a good idea. If the normal police would tell you, hey, you have to live your life that way because this is a safe way to do it, then you would say, thanks a lot, but I decide how I live. If you are talking about security in cyberspace, if some kind of guru tells you, hey, this is the security you need, these are the mechanisms you have to employ, then probably you will say, thanks a lot, but I decide what I want to do in cyberspace. Okay. Further proposals? Maybe you hand over the mic there.
So maybe the inflexibility in some kind is good too, because maybe you have some law you would apply and this is kind of an inflexibility. So if Amazon does want to sell books without any warranty, they cannot use the enforcement of German law because they say you have to give this warranty, and this is kind of an inflexibility you can rely on as a customer.
So again, I'm talking about computer security issues. I'm not arguing. Whenever you want to do a transaction, just start reinventing the law. This is not what I say. Because the law usually is made, at least European law, and I think for US American law the same applies, to protect the less powerful against the more powerful. So law mainly wants to impose some kind of fairness. I know this is somehow idealistic, because those having more money, more power, usually they can pay lawyers better, so they get the better lawyers, and so there's some limit to the kind of fairness you can achieve. But at least in principle, the law should help the less powerful guys. So in the background, in formulating that kind of definition, I have the law, of course, applies, giving me, for example, as a consumer, some rights. For example, if I want to buy a book, before I say I really buy it, I have a right to know the price and all the small print. So whenever any company would say, hey, first you order a book, and later on we will tell you how much it costs, and later on we will tell you what the small print is of the legal regulations of the contract law we apply, then this would be illegal in Europe and in the US. So some basic principles, of course, are encoded in laws. And usually this took centuries to get these laws in place. And it may be that if you will have a lot, an awful lot of experience with computer security, maybe that for some transaction types, we get quite detailed regulations how to provide for security and how not to. But if we get that, it should be based on a lot of experience. And you can only do it if your building blocks are stable. The security properties of those and that mechanisms are stable. Otherwise, if you would, let's say, require by law that you do it this way or that way, if the security of your mechanism may change within days, or at least it changes usually within years, it's just too fast for law to follow. So I would say we have as a basic platform law, and the monopoly of the government of the country for physical force, this I take as a given. And on that firm basis, we want to have more flexibility how to do computer security. And a hard-coded security regime usually won't work. Now go to the extreme other case, and if some people don't like to use hard-coded security, at the moment, what do they do? They don't use security at all. And therefore, I hope, I'm convinced that having some kind of flexible framework, starting that people think about what are my goals, not assuming that the transaction partner has the same goals as I. This is just a good starting point. And then thinking about how much can I secure that my goals are achieved. By some fairness principle, I should admit that the other party also wants its goals being achieved. Okay. Further remarks, further questions. Otherwise, I would say, okay, probably I've made it and talked long enough about that exercise. But I think it's essential to talk about it, because this is some kind of basis. And if we cannot agree on that, then probably we can talk about many, many, many details. But we don't have any further common vision where we want to get. Yes, so I would hope that this is a way
to motivate security.
So a way to frame multilateral security is then security you can motivate to people. Hopefully, yes. Okay, then probably we proceed with the lecture. Quite early, I told you that in talking about security, we have need some kind of protection codes. And of course, we have to spell out against whom we are enforcing those codes. What's the attacker? And in the next slides, I'm going deeper into protection codes. And the system I'm discussing is a computer network. And I try to look more in detail what kind of protection goals might be interesting. So in some sense, I'm refining protection goals towards a computer network. Of course, you could do the same exercise refining protection goals towards a database, towards any kind of generic IT system. I'm just doing it for computer networks. In computer networks, mainly, and first of all, we are talking about the content of communication, the content of messages that you write, I love you, or can we meet next week and have a party, or that you write, I would that you send me the most famous book of Immanuel Kant, maybe different message contents. Another story is the circumstances of your communication. You send it to your girlfriend, to your family, to a bookshop. You send it when? You send it from where? So if I know when you send it, then probably I know a little bit when are you sleeping, and when are you doing either business or your private life. If I get to learn from where you send it, I learn a little bit about your whereabouts. If you look at the protection goals as we started, I have the feeling that the start with the three protection goals, confidentiality, integrity, availability, maybe it's not the best starting point for refinement, because probably it's better to start with, we have protection goals which aim to prevent something which is not intended, to keep things secret, to avoid communication, to avoid information to flow. And we can discuss what are mechanisms to achieve the intended properties, to make sure that a message makes it from the sender to the recipient. If we start that way, then surely confidentiality is a green category, is a category of a protection goal describing how to prevent something which is not intended, how to keep be related to the message content, what I do here, how to keep the message content confidential. And then if you go to the right side, the question is, what corresponds to confidentiality of message content if we are talking about the circumstances of communication? And here, if you want to have something secret, it would be who communicates to whom. The circumstances of communication should be kept secret. And this property we might call anonymity. And there may be other properties, for example, you might keep secret from where you are communicating. So location may be something you might keep secret. Let's do the same exercise with integrity. Integrity of content means the message makes it as it has been sent to the recipient. Or the recipient clearly gets to know that the message has been manipulated, has been changed. What does correspond to that content property in the realm of a circumstances property? And here I would argue it's accountability. Accountability tells you who did what. So accountability makes sure that it can be proven that you sent a message. And of course, I would argue it should include which message you did send. So I could prove you sent a message. You sent this message. And maybe in some situations, it may be equally important to prove that someone got a message. Then I would like to prove that that person got a message. So accountability corresponds to integrity. One is a content property, or one I can take as a content property. And in the circumstances area, I would call that accountability. Availability with respect to message content means the message content gets available. That is, if I, the sender, want to send a message within a realistic time frame, the message makes it to the recipient. So the message content gets available to the recipient. What does it mean in the area of circumstances? There are different ways to refine that there. One way to do it is refining towards reachability. If I want to get the message content available to someone, usually what I really intend is I want to reach a person or maybe a computer. So it's not only a question that the message content might make it, but that it makes it to the right person, and hopefully that person really takes notice of that message. Another way to refine it is legal enforceability. With accountability, the main issue is I can prove what happened. So if you did order some goods, I can prove that you really ordered them. Does this mean I get money? It depends. If you have money, nice. If you are living under the same legal regime as I do, so I know you, I can send a police officer after you and chase you for the money, then maybe it's nice. But accountability only tells me I can prove it, but it doesn't provide for that I get the money you promised. With legal enforceability, I would describe a property that it is somehow guaranteed that within a realistic time frame, I really can force you by legal means to fulfill your promises. So this could be one way to refine protection goals towards a computer network. I have to admit there are different ways to do some kind of refinement. For me, the main correspondence is confidentiality towards anonymity, integrity towards accountability. Availability we refine to two things. And of course, I should mention hiding and unobservability now. If you are talking about keeping message content confidential, then usually persons or entities not being supposed to get to know the content usually learn that there is something they don't understand. If it's encrypted, you can read the bits, but probably you don't understand. And if you are not too stupid, then you know that you don't understand. And if you are a secret service, then probably you get emotional about not understanding it. Maybe even some private persons get emotional about that. But secret services get emotional about it in a professional sense, that they want it to be changed, surely. So some countries have laws that you are not allowed to code messages, to send messages the secret servant doesn't understand. So the question is, can we protect message content with respect to confidentiality in a way that a secret service or someone else tapping lines does not get that there is confidential content? And this property we call hiding. It's a property that you can hide secret information in a message which has some meaning everybody can understand, but in addition to that obvious meaning, it has some hidden meaning, some hidden message in it, which only the intended recipient can understand. Steganography would be a mechanism to provide for that. So if you ever are in countries who don't like confidential communication, then if you want to have something, you need hiding. In some countries, or in some situations, anonymity has some bad connotation. Not everybody likes it that he sees communication but cannot determine who is the sender and who is the recipient. So the question is, do we have something which corresponds to hiding in the area of circumstances? And here we could have mechanisms who just hide that communication takes place. Some forms of extreme dummy traffic, some more complicated mechanisms. We'll learn some of them in the spring term. Okay, so far the motivation for this. And now, of course, if you do some research about that, you have to write down what you really mean. Hopefully, I did give you an explanation now, a motivation, and I would argue, reading all that, it's not, let's say, necessary now. Maybe in going through the slides at home, maybe this is a text which helps you to reflect about what you just heard. If you have these kinds of protection goals, a natural question is, hey, are these protection goals independent of each other, or are there some kind of correlations? Meaning that, are there protection goals which nicely work together, which support each other? Are there protection goals which are contrary to each other, which exclude each other? Or are all these protection goals just indifferent to each other? They don't influence each other. And the answer is, there is a correlation, yes. And let's think about it. There are some protection goals where I would argue they are stronger than others in the sense that they imply other protection goals. For example, if you take the goal of hiding, you hide that you have a secret message. Then, of course, if your attacker cannot find that there is a secret message at all, of course he cannot get the content of the secret message. Because if he would get the content, he would see there is something. So surely hiding implies confidentiality. Using another example, if you have accountability, that is, you are able to prove who communicated with which message to whom in order to be able to go to court and just ask for your partner, your transaction partner, to keep his or her promises, then accountability, of course, implies integrity. Because if you are able to prove that this person did send that message, then it's clear that it did send that message, that this is the message content. So I would argue that each reasonable definition of accountability covers integrity of the message content. As a side remark, if you look into standards and other textbooks, they don't follow my argument. They try to define sometimes accountability without bothering about the message content. So then accountability is you can prove that that person did send some message. I would say that's completely useless. So please be warned. But I would argue, if you want to have accountability, this implies integrity. And I have very good arguments that this is a reasonable kind of definition. Of course, in mathematics, in the new formal system, you can define everything. But some definitions are more useful than others. Or, if you look at legal enforceability, if I say, hey, after a finite amount of time, maybe a court decides, and hopefully towards the person deserving the supporter decision, then of course legal enforceability implies accountability. Because if I want to provide a system where a trial is done in real time, the court, of course, needs all the proofs. It has to figure out who did send which message to whom and when. If I define availability with respect to messages, then, of course, a message is available if the true message content is available. Some textbooks, some international standards define availability as, in real time, some message is available. I don't care about the bits. But, okay, I would say this is absolutely trivial. I always built your system with nearly 100% availability by just having a random number generator. It generates you, let's say, a message whenever you want to get one. But not really useful in practice. So availability implies integrity. Of course, this kind of implication assumes a certain definition of availability. I relate it to a message. Of course, it could be a useful definition of availability not to be related to a particular message, but some textbooks, some standards related to the functionality of, in principle, being able to send messages. And then for them, availability means that within a realistic time frame, you are able to send a message, and after a finite number of tries, the message really makes it to the recipient. This could be another reasonable definition of availability, but now it's about the functionality of sending something. It's now not a definition of availability relating to message content. If you talk about reachability as a possibility of sender and recipient to control and know who can communicate to whom, when, and how, then surely reachability implies availability. Because if you want to have to control about who takes notice of what, as a base functionality, it's clear that the message has to make it real time, the message content. Otherwise, it's really hard to have a reasonable definition of reachability. Unobservability. If we have no clue whether there's communication at all, then of course this implies hiding. If you don't see whether there's communication at all, if there's communication, the content is perfectly protected, right? And of course, if you don't see if there's communication at all, it provides anonymity. If there's communication, we don't know who's communicating to whom, because we don't see any communication. Okay, so this was a discussion about implications. This was a discussion about very strong properties, a very strong relation. There are weaker relations. One weaker relation is a relation I called strengthens, that is, it supports, it helps. For example, confidentiality and anonymity strengthen each other. If the message content is confidential, you cannot learn something, who communicates to whom, just from reading the message content. And vice versa. If you don't know who is sending the message to whom, then this sender-recipient relationships, which you don't know, doesn't help you doing some inferences about the message content. So maybe if you know I send a message to, let's say, my wife, then chances are very good that it has something to do with our relationship. Maybe it's a message, I love you, whatever. If you know I'm sending a message to Emerson, it's very, very unlikely that the message content is, I love you. I don't say it's absolutely impossible, but I would say it's highly unlikely. Okay. I also would say that hiding strengthens anonymity, and in some sense you could try to formally conclude that if hiding implies confidentiality, and if confidentiality strengthens anonymity, then by transitivity you could have that. Of course, it's not only a possibility to strengthen. You might have the contrary. That is, you may have some properties which weaken each other. For example, anonymity, which is very nice for privacy, obviously does weaken accountability. So in some scenarios, you have to make sure what's more important. So probably if it's about, let's say, buying some very expensive stuff, then maybe complete anonymity is not what you want to do. On the other hand, are there compromises? Are there situations where you want to have both properties to hold? I would say in some situations, yes. For example, if you think about whistleblowing, telling you some truth about some company or politician, powerful entity, which tells the public that this entity does wrong or did wrong, then I want, of course, in some sense, to really establish this is really true, and accountability could be helpful for that. And on the other hand, of course, I would like to have anonymity for the person doing the whistleblowing, because, you know, in some countries, if you are going to give proof that the government is corrupt, then probably the chances that you are dead after a week dramatically are increased. So anonymity may be very important, because otherwise the message content never will make it, will not inform the public about wrongdoing of the government. So I say it weakens each other, and okay, but nevertheless, it might be very interesting to look for compromises. And we will see, mainly in the part two of the lecture, that pseudonymity, that is, parties acting under a pseudonym, maybe a good compromise. Maybe nobody has the relation between your pseudonym and the party, so in this sense it gives you anonymity. But acting under a pseudonym enables building up some kind of reputation. If, let's say, the pseudonym is a pen name, and in history we had that, and even in these days, pen names are in wide use, and you did read some reasonable articles, some well-researched articles published under a pen name, then if the next article really is breaking news, something you don't expect, then probably you will give it some thoughts. It's not a guarantee that it's true, but maybe it's worth thinking about. And if you are talking about digital pseudonyms, that is, pseudonyms which are, for example, a public key of a digital signature system, so you can authenticate messages according to the pseudonym, then this is a very useful mechanism. Because if you just have pen names, which is some bit string you just attach to some message, then I could take a well-established pen name and just append it to some message I composed. If we are using digital pseudonyms, then it's only the holder of the pseudonym, the person having the secret key to sign the message digitally, who can attach the pseudonym to the message. Okay, so far the correlations of these protection goals I want to discuss. Do you have questions? Everything clear or everything unclear? Silence can mean both. Where do we have the mic, please? Of course, it's always hard to tell, do I got all the relationships, because maybe I overlooked something. And maybe the definition of strengthen and weaken, when does it strengthen enough so to mention it? When does it weaken enough? So in some sense, it's not really precise. I hope that I made, I depicted the main properties. I'm not arguing that there's no other way to do the drawing. And of course, in some sense, it's crucially depending on how the definitions here are written. So by changing these definitions slightly, you could get changes in the implications and the strengthening and weakening. So the main thing of what I want to achieve is not, hey, these are the protection goals, and these are the correlations between them. I just want to convey to you some approach how to do it. You refine your protection goals. You think about it, what relationships are there. And this is what is important, not that you learn the particular protection goals and the particular relationships. So if you are building systems, and let's assume the relationships are that, then surely it's pretty clear if you offer hiding, then you cannot avoid, by offering hiding, to offer confidentiality of message content. This is just impossible. So it gives you some structure of your design space. Or if you talk about accountability, it should be clear to all of us now that this has to cover integrity of the message content. So the usual definitions which you read about accountability, which don't cover integrity of the message content, I would say this should be put into doubt. And hopefully this got over. I'm not saying this is the truth, but maybe you got some feeling, what are good questions? What do I have to ask if someone argues for this or that kind of definition for protection codes. And of course, if you even go one step further back, and if you say, hey, what are the conflicts? Because protection goals sounds nice, right? So if you wouldn't have, let's say, the weakening that protection goals weakens each other, then how would you argue? You would argue that, hey, if you're talking about security, and if protection goals would be neutral to each other or strengthening each other, then we would argue, hey, let's take all the protection goals. That's nice. No need to discuss which protection goals we take. We just take all of them. Great. Only disadvantage would then be maybe providing them would be too expensive because the security mechanisms are too expensive. But then I would argue, in the long run, technology gets cheap. So let's take all of them. And now you understand that this is a quite silly argument because you can't take all of them because there are some kinds of conflicts. And the most prominent conflict is here between anonymity and accountability. Usually, if you are a job, often you will have the clients, the users of your job, to be accountable. You are non-anonymous anyway, because usually if you are an ordinary shop, the legal system in job is that you have to give your place of residence, etc., etc. So no anonymity for you as the owner of the shop. So you want usually your clients to be accountable as well. Usually if you are some person ordering something, by default, I would say you would like to stay anonymous, at least if nothing strange happens. Let's say you are ordering tons of sweeties. You would like to stay anonymous because you feel, hey, if you don't stay anonymous, maybe your health insurance, if they know that you ordered tons of sweeties, will increase the money you have to pay for your health insurance, because tremendous consumption of sweeties is not good for your health. And even if you argue, hey, it's not for me personally, it's for other kids, nevertheless, they might try to increase your health insurance because maybe you give it to the kids, but someone has to pay for the damage all the sweeties does. So, okay. So you would like to stay anonymous. Maybe you bought these tons of sweeties. You caused damage to maybe you or your children. Then maybe after some while, you might be able to prove that, hey, it was me getting those sweeties. I suffered some damage, and now I want to reclaim something from the company selling me tons of sweeties. So, in my example, what I did now mention is, hey, maybe your protection goals are changing over time. Maybe in the beginning, anonymity was what you wanted to have. And maybe in a later phase, proving your identity was what you wanted to have. And this is something technology can support. The other way around, that in the beginning you want to be known, and after some while you want to be anonymous, this is much harder to support technologically. I would argue it's impossible, because how do you make sure something is really forgotten? You can hope that something will be forgotten. And for human beings, sometimes it works. But never ever, if you want something to be forgotten, tell something, hey, I'm relying on that you will forget it. This is a splendid bad idea. And having some security mechanism with the server, telling the server, hey, server, I really want to rely on that, you forget it. If I would be the Secret Service, I would make some arrangements with servers. Whenever they have to admit to or make sure that they forget something, this probably will be the most interesting information after that date. So as a Secret Service, I would like to be prepared. Okay, so protection goals, the desire for protection goals of some parties may change after some while, and some changes can be supported by technology and others probably not. Further questions, further remarks? Okay. Availability, I did define. I go back to the definition here and I read it. Availability ensures that communicated messages are available when the user wants to use them. And here I did mention communicated messages, not some different messages. And integrity, I did write down integrity ensures that modifications of communicated content are detected by the recipients. So for me, in the formulation of availability, in relying that it's about the message which has been communicated, I infer it's the original message. So if I would do some security mechanisms for availability, surely the availability mechanisms would cover, would include the integrity mechanisms. This would be the way I would implement it, and this is the way I did write down the definitions. As said before, we could do different definitions, and then we could have other implementations fulfilling these different definitions. Is this okay for you, or please ask back if you like? It's okay?
So I'm not really sure if legal enforceability fully implies accountability. Maybe sometimes you want to have the possibility to legally enforce something which is not able to be proven happening.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going back to the slide having the definitions in writing. So there I read, legal enforceability ensures that a user can be held liable to fulfill his or her legal responsibilities within a reasonable period of time. So here I refer to his responsibilities. And if I'm talking about communication in a network, I would argue that this covers accountability, which reads, accountability ensures that sender and recipients of information cannot successfully deny having sent or received the information. This means that communication takes place in a provable way. So given, again, these definitions, I would say the implication holds. Of course, you could define the terms differently. And depending on your application, depends, okay, it might be useful. I feel that having that kind of definition is helpful to construct e-commerce scenarios, for example. Further comments, further questions? If I got it right, acoustically, I would say yes. Okay. If you look at the protection goals, Do you have the feeling something is missing? I already mentioned that the change of protection goals is not represented in this kind of graphics. Some changes could be supported nicely. For example, in the beginning, there's only a few information about you. You mainly have anonymity. And then you want more information to get available later. This can be well supported by technology. Other things need so not. So changes of protection goals surely aren't addressed here. Are there other things which aren't addressed, which are missing? Because just to make clear what we are talking about, if you are talking about requirements, if you are building a system, and if you have forgot requirements, then usually it really gets expensive in the end. Because if you forgot something, okay, and this is mainly an art or maybe a quite early phase in engineering, so forgetting something is surely possible. So, okay, so what is missing? Just stress your fantasy. It took me some time to, so this kind of protection goals and this kind of schema I did together with a PhD student of mine mainly 10 years ago. And so 8 years after, I read it again. I discussed with next generation of PhD students. And we came across that what's missing is mainly properties which are not just relating two parties to each other or very few parties to each other, but properties which relate many parties to each other. Maybe it gets clearer what I mean if you look at this slide. Mainly, I did add data consistency, for example, a property making sure that the same data gets available to many parties at the same time. This is a property which is stronger than just accountability. So, and if I'm talking about the same data at the same time, then surely this gets an availability touch. So probably this gets to get fairness. So now this gets work in progress. I didn't spell out here particular definitions. All I wanted to say is, hey, this is not the end of the story. It's quite natural that if you get other applications, then probably other protection goals either are created or get discovered. So what you should take with you is not, hey, now I'm learning a long list of protection goals by heart. It's useless. Because what you will experience is if you are designing applications, if you are securing applications, probably still additional properties will get important. And those properties you have to secure are then protection goals, new protection goals. So for me, in my mind, protection goals which relate many people, the interests or the perception of many people towards each other or towards the data within the system. This is something which is badly covered here and which has somehow to be added, and this is just a first guess and has to be worked about during the next years. So maybe this now is a good point to go into the break. In 20 minutes, we continue. Enjoy your break. Okay. Over the break, I've got two questions where I think I should mention something to all of you. One question, again, was about observing versus modifying attacker. And maybe I should mention another name for observing attacker. Many years after I coined the terms observing versus modifying, in cryptography, some people started to call observing attackers honest but curious. So if you read in the cryptographic literature with relation to attackers the term honest but curious, then this is what I mean with observing. And now, hopefully, this term helps you to give you another, let's say, interpretation or another explanation. So the attacker is honest in the sense that it does, at least as it can be perceived outside, what it is to do. So it keeps the interfaces, it adheres to the protocols. So this is why there is the green part. But the attacker is not only honest, but curious as well. So whenever the attacker can get some information, he evaluates it, he stores it, he makes good use of it. So maybe to some of you, this kind of explanation might be helpful. If it's not helpful, forget it completely. Just take the last 2 minutes as part of your break. Any questions? Okay, then the next thing over the break I got is that I got the question, hey, aren't there more relationships like this? For example, shouldn't legal enforceability have some direct influence on integrity? And there, maybe I forgot to mention that, of course, if you have this kind of relationship, you can build the transitive closure. You know what a transitive closure is, right? So you might just add that. Then, of course, the graphics gets more complicated. And this is one reason why I didn't do that explicitly. But, of course, I should mention, surely the transitive closure should be something you keep in your mind, and, of course, it's valid. This was the second point. Okay, this was the last slide. Any further comments or questions from your point? Okay, then we proceed. Now I get deeper into some parts of security. And in some sense, I start bottom up. I try to explain to you how we can provide security. And the first and maybe most fundamental thing to mention is that whenever we talk about security, somewhere you will have physical security assumptions. In other words, security doesn't come out of nothing. You need some kind of basement to build upon. And this has to do with the physical world, with assumptions about the physical world. Each technical security measure needs a kind of physical anchoring in a part of the system which the attacker has neither read, access, nor modifying access to. So the assumption is the attacker cannot get at it, neither to read it nor to modify it. And the range of that kind of physical area or physical space can be, we assume the attacker has no access to the computing center, and this can be a large room like this, or maybe the whole premises of a computer department. And it can be pretty small. Maybe our assumption is that the attacker doesn't get at your smart card, doesn't get into the chip of your smart card. And of course, there's many in between. So if you are talking about assumptions, the question arises, what can be expected at best? So surely you can make any assumption, be it reasonable or not. And of course, if you say, this is a very fundamental assumption, you would like to be it a reasonable assumption, because otherwise, if the assumption is wrong, then all the conclusions you draw from your assumptions may be wrong. So what can be expected? First, availability of a locally concentrated part of the system cannot be provided against realistic attackers. Why? The attacker takes some explosives. That's it. Or is just stealing your card, is crumbling your card. So you cannot prevent that. So to get better availability, what we usually do is we go for a physically distributed system, assuming that the attacker cannot be at many places at the same time. So if you assume you have a gang of 10 terrorists, then maybe your data should be at least at 11 places, making sure that if any of the terrorists takes up or destroys completely one computing center, then still the 11th center survives. And of course, we should say that seems to scale well. In particular, if you have a distributed system anyway, and maybe companies give a possibility for other companies to use their facilities as a backup, or if you are distributing your important data with your friends, hopefully somehow encrypted, come to that later, then it may be really a problem to erase all the copies physically. But of course, if you're going to distribute data by replication, then this makes confidentiality and integrity of your data more difficult. Because now, in my example, it's enough to get at the data in one of 11 places, and then you have the data. And if you don't have any mechanisms for integrity, it may be enough if you are able to change data at one of the 11 places. Then maybe dirty data, changed data, is used by someone. Or maybe, depending on the kind of security you implement, maybe it's necessary to change the data at 6 places, then you have changed the majority of places. So in any case, confidentiality and integrity gets more difficult by distributing, by replicating your data in a physically distributed system. So the question is physical distribution helpful? Availability gets better, but integrity and confidentiality gets worse. So which does outperform what? And here the remark is that physical measures concerning confidentiality and integrity are more efficient. You can try to provide confidentiality and integrity against all realistic attackers. For example, you have some kind of black box, and if someone tries to open it, it will just erase the data. Okay, not trivial to implement that, I come to that later, but maybe conceivable. Whereas protection of availability, protecting hardening something against explosive, that's really hard. And I don't see a really useful way to do it. Of course, even if you replicate, of course, you would still invest some mechanisms to protect the single computing center. So even if you have 11 ones, probably you will not invite people with tons of explosives to get at your computing center, I assume. So maybe you will have some fence, hopefully made of roses and not of barbed wire, and try to keep people with machine guns and explosives and other kinds of weapons out. So, what we need to keep data confidential and to protect the integrity is some kind of tamper-resistant casings. They have some kind of basic properties. First, if you are tampering with such a box, it should be detected. Then, of course, you have to judge whether this kind of interaction with the box is okay. Maybe it's maintenance, or whether this is some kind of attack. And hopefully you react accordingly. So if it's an attack, what might you do? Depends on what kind of application we are talking about. In the military area, you would usually include quite a bit of explosive in your box. So if some tampering is detected, it's just blown up. Of course, this is not really nice for civilian applications, where some children might be very curious what's inside the box and try to get at it. And then blowing up your children probably is not a splendid good idea, right? And getting into a plane with such a box maybe neither be a good idea, right? So for civilian applications, probably we would like to erase secrets or data electronically, which usually takes slightly longer than just blowing up the box, because maybe you have to override it several times. Maybe some storage media are such that the new storage content has to be present at least a few seconds, because otherwise you may have some hysteresis, things like that. So it might be good that attacks are somehow delayed. It takes some time. So you have time to delete your data. So, what do we know about that? in the public area? Not really much. Usually it's the secret services, it's the military constructing that kind of boxes. Probably you never heard about that, or at least you can't buy it off the shelf in MediaMarkt or Saturn or your local computer shop. So the state of knowledge about that area is not as good as I would like it to be, assuming or giving credit to the fact that this is the fundamental thing we are building upon. So usually you should very well know your fundamentals. And here, I have to admit, it's not really much what we know. But we have a possibility that if you don't trust a single layered system, just use several layers, be it for detection, be it for judgment, for shielding, for delaying. And only in the most inner part you have your data, and there you have to have enough time to delete your data. So it might look like this, that in the gray area, this is hard material to delay the attacks. Maybe within that material, you have all kinds of sensors for vibration or pressure. Then in the yellow part, you have some kind of shielding and judging. And in the innermost part, you have your data and a functionality to delete your data. Now, if you feel that you need more sensors, more shielding for delay, then you're just duplicating the gray shields. If you have the feeling you should do more shielding, more judging, okay, then duplicate the two outermost layers. And maybe if you don't trust your delete function, then even that could be duplicated. And of course, if you don't trust that, you can start triplicating. And if you continue, then in the end, probably, you will have a quite bulky device, which surely will not be part of your mobile phone, I assume. But at least in principle, if you don't trust a single layer, you can do with several layers with replication of functionality. And if you implement that independently, then okay, it might work. The problem, of course, is how do we some kind of validation? How do we achieve by validation and other mechanisms some kind of credibility? And so what to do? May I ask you, how do you personally master that kind of challenge within your life? What do you do? Probably you take those parts of your computer system which are the most fundamental thing for you. I assume you take that with you. Right? Usually I have this in my purse, so I have it with me. Maybe if I look inside it, this is a complete backup of my hard drive with respect to the most essential data I have, right? I take that with me. Oh, okay, now I have to put it in again. So typically, it's not only about technology, it's about organization as well. So you take it with you. There is, I would say, a negative example, and this is about smart cards, about chip cards. Usually, this is what people will tell you is a tamper-resistant casing. And they argue that nobody ever will get at the data inside that chip. And at least in the past, this has been a plain lie. Of course, it's always risky to talk about the future, but in the past, it wasn't true. Why? In a chip card, first, there's no detection mechanisms. So here, there's no battery. There's no continuous monitoring what's done physically. So an attacker has plenty of time tampering with that device. Secondly, with chip cards, shielding is difficult. Why? Because it should be possible to put it into a purse. It should be able to bend it, and maybe even that way. Because usually, if you take it with you, you are not constructed out of planes. You are constructed out of curves. So this has to be reflected here. So shielding is difficult. And in addition, usually, in this kind of design, there's no deletion of data intended. Thus, usually there's no erasure of data. And even not after power is supplied again. Of course, I have to admit that over the last 25 years, this is mainly the time frame so long are chip cards fabricated. They got somehow more secure, yes. But of course, the machinery of those attackers trying to disassemble and to get at the data surely got more capable as well. So it's unclear how secure they are. So what do we learn? We learn a first golden rule. If possible, you should have a correspondence between organizational and IT structures. You should have a correspondence between how people live and behave, how the physical world is organized, and the IT structures we are developing and we are attaching to the physical world. That is, if it's hard to have tamper-resistant casings, your attention, your capability to take things with you should be used just to say, hey, for some of your data, your capability to take it with you is some kind of defense for your data. You have it with you. So for others, it's difficult to get at it without you noticing it. Usually, if I go to the restroom, I take this with me. I leave my laptop here over the break, but surely my purse and maybe my chip card and, of course, my backup, I take with me. So you should do as well. And if you are constructing large-scale systems, it would be a splendid good idea to make good use of that kind of property, that each person, quite naturally, is some kind of protection area for him or herself. Not perfect. Of course, you could try to get at my purse. Let's say, put out your machine gun and say, hey, please hand over your purse. And probably if I'm not too stupid, I would say, okay, here you have it. And by the way, just start reading my backup, and then hopefully you're busy for quite some while and I get away. Nice. Maybe I try to get a hero, and then the question is, do you really make use of your machine gun? Or, okay, but usually won't find out. But just make sure approaching some person and saying, hey, if you don't hand it over, I'll get violent. This is really a step only a few people would dare to do. Secret services usually don't do that. Police usually is only allowed to ask you for that in very well-defined situations. And probably until now, nobody of you had a clue that I have my backup within my purse. So probably if your main intention would have been just to destroy my data, probably you would be completely happy if I hand over my laptop and maybe access to all the other backups I have. So the point I want to make is, because physical security is in a state of affairs that it's surely not perfect. And if you want to be it really valid, it gets expensive. So please make good use of organizational structures which already are in place. I mainly argued for the individual, but the same applies to organizational structures. A computing center usually has some walls, has some organization not letting everybody in, etc. Make good use of that. So this is the first golden rule. Please never ever forget that. Because mainly it comes for free. And for the trustworthiness of what you are doing, it's essential. If you ask a person, hey, to store your data securely, please give it away. We are going to store it in the cloud. They will give you a smile. If you don't build your system that if they like to, they can keep the data with them, knowing that there really are small computers, they are really mass storage devices, pretty small. If you build your system that they can't get the data with them, why should they trust you? And it's only if you need some kind of backup, that maybe a backup of your data, hopefully well encrypted, has to be stored somewhere else. Okay. First golden rule, and maybe one of the really important rules. Now let's assume you have a physical area which is somehow protected, be it technically, be it organizationally. How do we make sure to whom we are talking? How do we do some kind of identification? I won't talk much about how human beings identify other human beings. Probably you all enjoyed some training about that. It starts within the family. You start learning, these are my parents, maybe my brothers, my sisters, my friends. Okay. I take for granted that somehow you know how to identify and recognize other persons. So mainly, now if you're talking about computers, there are three other things I have to discuss. How does a person identify a computer? How does a computer identify a person? And how do computers identify themselves? Or each other, I should say. Okay, let's start with identification of human beings by IT systems. How does the computer, there's a question mark, make sure what the human being is? And there usually we have three possibilities. The computer might check what one is, mainly what the body is or how the body behaves, what one has, some kind of token, passport, whatever, or what someone knows, be it secrets, passwords, whatever. So let's look at it in detail. What one is, it might be the computer is looking at the hand geometry, the relative length of the fingers. Maybe the computer looks at the fingerprint. I assume if some of you have laptops with you, at least in some of them there will be fingerprint readers. Your computer or a computer could look at a picture of you. Some computers have cameras built in. Handwritten signature, written pattern, voice, and last not least, typing characteristics. Each two people type differently. Computer might check what one has, paper documents, metal key, magnetic stripe cards, smart cards, or calculators. Or might check what you know, passwords, passphrases, answers to questions, and maybe it checks even calculation results for some numbers the computer delivers to you, making sure that replay doesn't work. And what do we do in practice? If you really want to check who you are, you do some combination of things. On an ID card, usually you have a picture, you have a handwritten signature, and it's a paper document. So first you check whether someone has an ID card at all, and then you check whether the picture fits to the appearance of the person. And the handwritten signature, you might ask the person, please sign, and then you compare. And the new generation of passports, you have even a fingerprint and a smart card. So your ID card can do some calculations and they can check your fingerprint. The smart card is a splendid good idea, I would argue, because now your passport gains some autonomy, can do some calculation, can, as we will see later, do some cryptography. Whether gathering and storing fingerprints are really a good idea, I would say I'm severely in doubt. Because if in checking your passport, your identity, you are expected to put your finger on a foreign device reading your fingerprint, then the operator of that device gets a large collection of fingerprints, which can be used to build fingerprint replicas where it can leave wrong traces on scenes of crime, getting police directing their effort in looking for the criminals in quite a wrong direction. So this is the set of tools you can employ if a computer is going to check who the person is. And if people, or in the literature, it is talking about identification, then this is what everybody has in mind. This is the reverse question. How does a human being, the question mark now is with the human being, check whether this is the right computer, whether this is the computer he should use? And this might be a problem. If you're using a computer, let's assume this is an automatic teller machine, you should really be interested, is this an automatic teller machine operated by your bank, or is this an automatic teller machine replica operated by some kind of mafia, or a Russian gang, or whatever you have, maybe a German gang as well, sure. If you put in your secret, your magnetic stripe card, your PIN, into the wrong computer, it shouldn't be much of a surprise if your money disappears later on, because you gave your card and your secret to someone you don't know. And just to mention, there are several tricks. The most obvious trick was building an automatic teller machine replica a few centimeters in front of a normal automatic teller machine, just making sure you put in your secret at the replica, you put in your magnetic stripe bank card there, and then on the screen you get wrong PIN, please repeat. You type in your PIN a second time, you get wrong PIN, please repeat. And be warned, if the next time it's a wrong PIN, we will keep your card. You type in your PIN a third time, and of course the answer you get, wrong PIN, so we keep your card. And if you do that on a Saturday morning, maybe on a Friday evening would do as well, then you have quite some time to recover the cards of many people. You made them type in their PIN three times, so hopefully one of the three times it's really the PIN corresponding to the card. And then you have the original card and the original PIN. And you get the money. So how do you make sure that you're talking to the right computer and not just putting your card and your secrets into someone else's computer? So one way is, have a look at the casing. And I would even say, more particularly, have a look at the pollution of the casing. If I should make a distinction between my Macintosh and someone else's Macintosh, probably it's only the pollution which is unique to my machine, or the 17-inch current Macintosh look like this. It's the pollution which makes a difference. So you should really know how your keyboard looks like. Maybe computers should bear some seal and hologram. There may be serial numbers, or maybe in buying your computer, you should show up with a, let's say, picture either of you or your girlfriend or your most famous movie star and say, hey, I want to have a hologram on my computer with this face. Or you might check what your computer knows, a password. So maybe if you approach your bank computer, your automatic teller machine, before you type in your password, probably first the automatic teller machine should answer some of your questions. But be sure, if it's a replica in front of the original machine, it's pretty easy to pass through your questions, get the answer, and then display the answer to you. So, okay. Not each security mechanism helps against each kind of threat. Maybe the computer should do some calculations for numbers you provide, so helping to avoid replace. And of course, and this may be the most important thing, you should really check where the computer stands, the physical position of the computer. So probably, I hope you know, plus minus 1 millimeter where the automatic teller machine stands, which you are using, right? Reasonable assumption. No, it's ridiculous. But this is what you should do. Let's assume you only know it plus minus 10 centimeters. This is an awful lot of space building a replica in front of the machine. Or you should really know how the terminal looks like. Would you use a terminal which looks different? Probably yes. You would assume, hey, this is a new brand of automatic teller machine. Did your bank ever inform you that they are installing a new brand of automatic teller machines with a new design? I never heard that from my bank. But maybe they did a recording that I never wanted to have a PIN, so they don't inform me, but they inform the rest of the world. But I can't believe they are so clever. So probably, more or less, if you are realistic, you have no clue how the machine should look like, the automatic teller machine, and where exactly it stands. So what do we learn? Probably you learn, since seals, holograms, pollution often do not work with other persons' machines. Passwords, answers to questions, calculation for results of number can be played back if you did put something in front of the machine. And since you have no clue where a machine really stands, probably all you learn is you should never ever put one of your secrets into a foreign machine because you have no clue. So you shouldn't do that. So what should you do? Probably you take your machine with you. How many machines do you have with you? I would assume each of you has at least a mobile phone. Some of you have a laptop with you. So why, for devil's sake, should you put in your secret into a foreign machine? That's stupid, because you cannot check. So put it in your machine. And then it all comes down to how do we make sure that devices identify each other and know how they communicate. And this is how we might do that. Of course, devices might ask for passwords, answers to questions, calculation result for numbers, but that's child games. Mainly what devices can do is they can use cryptography to make sure to whom they are talking to. And that in my example of the automatic teller machine, you should type in your PIN into your device. You take with you your mobile phone, your laptop. And then it has to be transferred to your bank using cryptography, making sure that it's encrypted under the right key for your bank. And then no need to bother whether there's some intermediary device in between, yes or no, it doesn't matter. So this is the way it should be constructed. Just for completeness, I mention that, of course, you might check what is the other computer by checking from where the cable comes. Sounds nice to follow this cable, so maybe you know where it's ending. If you go to a computing center, if you try to do the same, okay, it's a mess. If you are talking about radio, you cannot follow the path of the radio signal. It's mainly broadcast in a local area. It doesn't work. So mainly from where the wire comes is not really useful, maybe with the exception of printed cards where we have fixed chips on the same printed card and it's static. Maybe then from where the wire comes is helpful for security, but nothing if it's about longer wires in the real world or even radio. Okay, so this was after we started with physical security. The next step, we have to identify physically secure areas and make sure we are communicating, we are interacting with the right area. Okay? Any questions so far?
One question. If the person used fake machine and their money were stolen from this machine, from his bank account, so is bank responsible for this and will he return the money to the person, or how is it organized in this way? These cases will exist, and how does it work?
The answer to your question surely depends on whom you are asking. If you ask me, I would say the main culprit, the main person responsible is the designer of the system. So maybe some computer scientists a long time ago. And since we don't know them any longer, maybe they are dead in the meantime, it's the entity running the system. It's the bank. So the bank should take responsibility.
Thank you.
So what do banks do? Of course, they know about the insecurity of their systems. Of course, if you ask them, they will say, our systems are perfectly secure. But inside their heads, they know. So what do? They have a lot of fine print saying that if you take your bank card and your PIN, you take responsibility on what is done with that. And it's pretty clear you have to use automatic teller machines if you want to get cash. How do you make sure you are using only the right machines? So I never saw any bank giving me a complete description of all the machines, giving me a map with all the machines plus minus a few millimeters. So they require you to really check it, but they don't give you the information which is necessary to do that. So the basic construction of the system is that it's not about multilateral security. The system is built and the fine print is written down with the intention securing the bank against the customer, but not securing the customer against the bank. So for the first decade of operating that system, it worked very fine for the banks. Whenever money was stolen and you had a trial of a private person, a bank client, against the bank, what did the judge say? The judge said, hey, usually banks are not really cheating with their clients. If they want to cheat, they increase, let's say, some fees they take, or they sell some kind of stupid investments. But usually they don't cheat directly. But private persons, yes, some of them are cheating. So if something happened, it's usually the private person. And for the first decade, they assumed, hey, computers, they never make mistakes. This was the myth of that time. In the meantime, even judges are working on personal computers. So they experienced that software crashes. Their computer crashes. So the myth of a computer never makes mistake, it's broken down. And secondly, we gave enough information to judges that they have the feeling that a system to get cash could be constructed differently. So building it only with the security of the bank in mind is not an act of God, it's not a necessity, but it's a deliberate decision of the bank to do it that way. And therefore judges say, hey, irrespective of what the fine print is, the bank has a burden of proof. At least this is the ruling of the judge if you have a good lawyer as a private person. And now the banks are losing all the trials. Usually before they lose it, they do some kind of arrangements out of the trial. They, let's say, cover all the damages and you refrain from trialing. So the lesson to be learned there is, in the beginning, building a unilaterally secure system for the banks was a success. But in the long run, the system which was in the beginning secure for the banks now is completely insecure for the banks. And you don't need much fantasy to know or to learn to find out how you in the meantime could cheat banks. In the meantime, you have all information you need really to do it at a large scale. I don't want to repeat it. I don't want to bring it in the right order and give you hints, but it's quite obvious how you could do it. I don't say you should do it because it's surely cheating someone. And this is nothing I want to advocate for. But, okay. Which brings me back to what we started discussing a few hours ago. You have to build it in a multilaterally secure way. So the security interests of each party are fulfilled, and then you get hopefully a better system. And if it's only unilaterally secure, then the party building the system will be in a very weak position, because a judge, if he's informed about the possibilities, would say, in building it only unilaterally secure, you made a mistake, and you therefore have to cover all the damages. Okay? Any more questions? Okay, then we'll proceed. So let's assume we had a black box, a box which we can physically protect, or which humans physically protect. We have some kind of identification. Nice. Now, within that box, we are doing some computing. Nice. And we have some human beings who want to have some computing to be done, want to have some access to data. What do we have to do? And here we have two terms. One is admission control, and the other term is access control. The picture is you have a person, you have some kind of terminal, and then you have this box